Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I am your host, Nick Bilton. So this past week has been, without question, one of the most insane things that I have ever seen and probably will ever see. It has happened with such speed and such ferocity, and just it's whiplash, essentially, is the only way I can describe what we are all going through. It happened so quickly. I remember just about 10 days ago, 8 days ago or so, in a meeting explaining what I thought may happen, and everyone kind of looking at me like I was insane. And sure enough, it was 10 times worse than I imagined. And we went from, you know, discovering that an NBA player had coronavirus to the industry shutting down, to every industry shutting down, to Tom Hanks, to it's just been astounding. We now have cities on lockdown. We have a barge on the Hudson that's a hospital that can hold 1,000 beds. We have stadiums being converted into potential hospitals for the influx of patients that may come. Thousands of deaths globally. It's unbelievable. And I think that one thing that I have that's really been kind of sobering for me in the past week is that for the past 15 years of my career, I have interviewed experts. You know, I would write stories for the Times and Vanity Fair and write books, and you call someone and you interview them and you ask them how something's going to happen, how it's going to play out, or what took place, and you always get an answer. And certain times you'll get someone who says, you know, I don't 100% know, but here's my theory. You never get anyone that says, I just don't know. And what has happened with the coronavirus, when I speak to experts, whether it's doctors, politicians, bankers, people in the private sector, teachers, I mean, just anyone that I've spoken to, epidemiologists, screenwriters who've made movies about these topics, the answer consistently has been the same, that no one knows. Like, no one knows how this is going to play out. And anyone who tells you they do is completely full of shit. This is unlike anything we have ever seen before. It's unlike anything that we have experienced globally before, even compared to the Spanish flu. This is the speed with which this has happened, because of the speed of information, because of this ability to, you know, fly around the globe at any given point in time, and all of the airlines that were doing so. It has spread much quicker. It's going to impact us much quicker, and our countries have shut down much quicker, and so we don't really know what's happening. We can kind of guess a little bit, but just to be aware, anything you read, you know, anyone that tells you anything, they're just guessing. So you have to take it all with a grain of salt. You have to kind of understand that the things that you're hearing, the things that you're reading, the things that you're seeing, they're all just people kind of trying to figure out what's happening. And it's going to be a little while before we really know how this is going to play out. I just want to go through some of the numbers with you. It's funny. I used to wake up every morning and you know, check my email and look at the weather and you know, read the news and things like that. And now the first thing I do is go to the coronavirus outbreak numbers and see how much it's spread. We're now Thursday morning. 231,000 cases so far globally. We've had almost 9,500 deaths. The serious or critical health rate, where people are in ICU or on you know, ventilators or so on, is between 5% and 9%, depending on the time of day that you look. We're seeing a massive rise over the past week, both, you know, linearly and logarithmically, of both deaths and cases. What's really interesting, I think, is and what will be interesting to see in the next week or two is how different countries fare. And I think the reason for that is because everyone's taking a kind of a different approach. You have China, which has completely locked down certain parts of the country, and other parts of the country are just normal. I have friends who work in manufacturing, deal with people in China. Their factories are still running. They're still up and going, and yet you can't go into certain parts of the country. And it has essentially, if we are to believe the numbers, and I'm not 100% sure if we should, but if we do believe the numbers, they have locked it down by essentially locking down part of the country. South Korea has taken a different approach where, you know, there are now 8,500 cases in South Korea. And the way that they have approached it is by extreme testing, by tracking. And it's actually, you know, they have flattened the curve in a way that's quite astounding. And I urge you to go and look at some of the ways South Korea has dealt with things. Italy has, of course, fared terribly in this. And it is devastating to hear what's happening over there. I definitely urge you to go listen to the episode of The Daily this week where an Italian doctor was on explaining what it's like in the hospitals there. It'll bring you to tears. There are, as of Thursday morning, 36,000 cases there, almost 3,000 deaths. On Wednesday, they had the highest number of new cases they've had to date, almost 5,000. You know, we have Iran, which is just kind of continuing on the same path that it's been on with 1,000 or 2,000 new cases a day. They're up to 18,500. What's going to be fascinating, I think, over the next week or two is to see how England fares. England, Boris Johnson decided, okay, we're not going to shut down the country. We're not going to close the schools. And while, you know, I have family in England and have spoken to them, there have been a run on the supermarkets and you can't really get anything. And a lot of people are staying indoors. You know, life is still somewhat going on. And so the virus has had a much easier ability to spread. And I think that we're going to really see how that's played out. And it's going to be very informative for how long we're going to be inside, I think, in America. In England, there's only really around 2,700 cases so far. Some of the hospitals are stretched to the limit because those cases are in specific areas. But I think over the next week, we're really going to see how that plays out. I want to go through some of the numbers for jobs. One thing that has been so staggering, and my guest today is going to talk about this. It's Kai Ryssdal. He's the reporter and host of Marketplace and an incredibly smart guy. He is coming on for about a half hour. We recorded the show on Tuesday, so some of the numbers are a little off, but actually surprisingly not that much. And Kai really is kind of going to explain, you know, what's the difference between a recession and a depression, how this is really going to change the way society works, the jobless numbers, where the money's coming from to kind of send out possible checks, all these different things. But one thing that is just staggering to look at is the national unemployment claims already this week. If you look at unemployment claims over the last, you know, year or so, they've kind of fluctuated a little bit, not much, but around, you know, 280,000, 260,000, 270,000 jobless claims a week. And just this week, in just 15 states, 630,000 jobless claims have been filed. So that is, and that number is going to be well over a million when all the claims come in. If you look at California alone, you know, last week there were 58,208 claims in California for jobless claims. And just this week, it has soared to 190,000. Ohio went from 7,000 to 78,000. Minnesota from 4,000 to 50,000. Rhode Island from 1,000 to 10,000. And I think that this is really kind of an eye-opening look at how we're going to be affected by this. I mean, if you look at these specific states, what's terrifying is that even after 2008, when the jobless claims jumped as a result of the crash, they never even remotely came close to this. In 2008, in Ohio, for example, jobless claims went from, around 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 to 40,000. Now they're at 80,000. And in Minnesota, they came very close to 20,000, but didn't really go, didn't really get any higher. And now we're at 50,000. And so I think that these numbers are indicative of the fact that this is going to not just be a recession, but likely be a depression, and it's going to change the way the economy looks completely. One last thing before we jump to Kai is one of the things we've been talking about over the last week is how many people could be infected as a result of this virus, and how many people could die. And I just want to put into perspective some of these numbers. I've been looking at some recent statistics and some kind of potential scenarios, and I just kind of want to walk through some just to kind of paint the grim picture of what this reality could look like. You know, there's a lot of guesstimations of what the fatality rate is for coronavirus. Right now, if you look at the number of cases and you look at the number of people who have passed away, it's around 3.4, 3.8%, give or take, on a different day. There are a lot of people who think that the number of cases is actually lower, and while there are around 250,000 cases right now, there are probably closer to 500,000 or even 1 million, and that the virus is affecting certain people in a much more kind of cold-like, flu-like way. And as a result, the fatality rate is probably closer to 1%. But let's just say that that is the case. If the fatality rate was 1% and we only saw a 10% infection rate in the United States, that's still 333,000 people who would die. That's more than Alzheimer's, strokes, diabetes, pneumonia, liver failure, all these different things. It's more people that die from guns every year. If you were to keep that fatality rate at 1% and you were to infect 40% of the population, which is a very real scenario, you would kill 1.36 million people in the United States. That's more than heart disease, more than cancer, more than Alzheimer's. And it's more than those things almost put together. I think that the most terrifying scenario, and I think the one that actually made Donald Trump really kind of realize what was happening, because he was for a long time calling this a hoax and saying that the virus was gone and so on and so forth, is if we get to a 70% infection rate, which is what Angela Merkel of Germany believes will happen globally, or at least in Germany, and she is a scientist, so she definitely knows what she's talking about. A 70% infection rate with a 1% fatality rate is 2.4 million deaths. Now, that doesn't take into account the fact that if you look at those numbers of 5% to 9% of people ending up in critical care, if those people all got sick at the same time and they were not able to get on ventilators, get the right medication, things like that, that number could be much, much higher. And I think that's why it's so important to stay indoors. It's so important to practice social distancing. And I think we're not really going to know, again, coming back to what I said in the beginning here, we are not going to know how this is going to play out in any way, shape, or form for a couple of weeks, because this virus has a 2-day to essentially 14-day incubation period where you're still spreading the virus. For the first week that you are sick, you're not necessarily, on death's door kind of sick. It's not until the second week that people end up in the hospital. It's not just killing people that are elderly or putting them at risk. There's numbers out from the CDC today that half of the patients in ICU right now in the United States are under the ages of 60. You have people in their 30s that are, on ventilators and been put into comas. This is bad, and it's not just affecting the elderly. It's affecting everyone, and these numbers are kind of terrifying. One last thing I think that's going to be really interesting to keep track of over the next week is Trump invoked, the fact that he's now a wartime president. And I think that, one of the things that does is it allows him to take private industry and apply it to essentially attacking this virus defending ourselves against it. And I actually do think that it is the best analogy to think of this as a world war. It is a complete global world war against a virus, not against each other, at least for now. And what can happen in these scenarios, and one thing that I've heard floated, and you may have seen some people talk about this on some of the news networks, is that, you know, one way to approach this would be to take all of these industries, car makers, you know, air conditioning makers, you name it, and for them to start making ventilators. And there are certain places that are talking about it. GM is talking about it. Elon Musk is talking about it, of course, because he has to get in there. You know, there's all these different places that are talking about it. And I hope that they actually do this, because what you could do is okay, for 30 days, we're going to be on lockdown, where no one's going to go out of their house. We're going to create thousands and thousands of masks and tens of thousands of ventilators and all these different things, and we are going to prepare as if we are at war, literally, like we are at war and we're about to go out into the battlefield, and we need to be able to get people ready. You could start to train certain doctors that are not specialists, and this is what they're doing in Italy. They're taking the cardiology doctors, and they're taking 10,000 student doctors, and they are making them into doctors. They are fast-tracking their graduation so that they can be prepared for this war. And I think that, you know, the next 30 days are really going to be telling about how this plays out, if we can approach it in that same respect. I don't necessarily know if the Trump administration is listening to what the experts are saying in regards to that. I think that there's a little bit of cross your fingers and hope this goes away, which is not going to happen under any circumstance. It's going to have to be incredibly proactive, not reactive, which is what the Trump administration usually does with everything. And so I think that, you know, if we start to see those kinds of actions take place, I think we will be much better off. And if we don't, we might have to start kind of trying to figure out how to make the government listen to that. So next up, we have Kai Ryssdal. He's going to talk a little bit about the economy. One thing that I found pretty staggering about this conversation, and I do want to say excuse me for any of the pauses and me not having my questions completely lined up. I was working from home for the first time with my two toddlers here running around trying to get into my office as I was recording. So it's there's a few little interruptions. I apologize in advance about that. But one thing that Kai's points out, and I think has become more clear since I did the interview with him on Tuesday, is that what is happening right now has never happened before in the history of the economy. It is, you know, we've had slowdowns in certain markets and industries, but we have never seen essentially the market stop. We haven't seen the airline industry stop. We haven't seen restaurants close globally. We haven't seen trade between certain countries with certain aspects slow down to the degree that it has. And I think that even if we were to fix this virus tomorrow, which is not going to happen, but even if we were, the world has changed, and it has changed in ways that that are going to be staggering to see. There are stores that will not come back. There are industries that will not come back. We are going to see a fundamental change to society as a result of this that we will never see again in our lifetime. And it's going to fast track certain industries to die that were on their way there already. It's going to make other industries grow in ways that would never have happened before. And it's really just going to change the landscape of cities around the world and the way we interact as human beings. And so it's really kind of sobering to think about that. And so I'm going to turn it over to Kai now, and we'll see you soon. Kai, welcome to the show in this very, very, very bizarre moment in time. I don't even know where to begin. And by the time we finish recording this, there will be some other insane thing that has taken place.
Yeah.
When was the last time anything like this even came remotely close to happening on a global level? Has it ever?
Never. Never. And this is the defining characteristic of what's happening now. You know, we have vocabulary for when an economy slows, right? We call it a recession or a slowdown, or the economy is sluggish. We don't have words for what's happening right now because the economy is stopping, right? Airlines are stopping. Travel is stopping. grocery stores and restaurants and bars, they are all stopping, you know? And it's just, it's the most remarkable thing.
What? Let me just ask a question real quick. We have vocabulary for recession and we have vocabulary for a depression. And some people, there's been all these people talking about, is this a recession or a depression? Is it either or? And what is the difference between those things? First of all, it'd be great to hear you explain that. But also, or is it something that we've never heard of before?
Well, so look, so depression is systemic, right? And it approaches, I mean, if you think about the Great Depression, and it's actually really interesting you raise this question now, because here as we speak, and this is now Tuesday afternoon, so as you said in the beginning, things are going to change. There's a report out on Bloomberg today that Secretary Mnuchin was talking about unemployment levels approaching 20%, 20%, okay? Mm-hmm. Unemployment levels in the Great Depression were 25%. Unemployment levels in the Great Recession were 10%. So that's a really good indicator of the severity of what we are looking at here, right? Depressions are systemic, they are lasting, and they are society shaping, right? In a way that run-of-the-mill recession certainly, and even the Great Recession are not quite. And that is the scope and scale of what we're looking at, which is unbelievable. But look, if you think about the fact that Marriott is already coming out and saying there are going to be tens of thousands of layoffs, then you get to a 20% unemployment number really, really quickly.
What is the, when you get to these numbers really quickly, one of the things that I've been so confused about is the way the markets have been reacting to this crisis. I mean, I remember I had someone on the show about 2 months ago where I asked, like, why haven't the markets reacted to the coronavirus?
Right.
And a month later, they finally started, not even a month later, I mean, it was like, over a month later, they finally started to do that. And it seems like I don't understand when they go up. Is it just that are they only able to see 3 feet in front of them? I mean, the long term effects of these. It doesn't take an economist or someone with whose uncle went to MIT to realize this is a downward spiral. Like, how are they responding? Are they responding because they see something we don't?
Well, so the first thing you have to understand about the markets is that they are plus or minus 70%. Algorithmically driven, right? That's computers executing high-speed trades based on signals that they pick up from news reports and whatever else they're looking at, right? So on a day when the president comes out and says, listen, we're injecting, we've got a $1 trillion stimulus program, here's why it's going to be better and we're going to get this thing under control, then you see markets up 5 or 6%. But when you see signals from companies or from other individuals in the news saying, yeah, we're not quite sure what's going on here, we don't know what our earnings are going to be, those algorithms pick that up and they trade on that information. So that's the first part, right? The overwhelming majority of the trades. The other thing you have to factor in here is simply human uncertainty. The speed with which this is happening, literally the uncertainty about what is going to happen, because we don't know what this is going to look like in 48 hours, right? Forget about even, this afternoon, right? 48 hours from now, we don't know what this is going to look like. So when you're thinking about the stock market and you're thinking about companies, big and small, having to figure out their business plans for the next 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, they can't do that. And what you're going to see happening, by the way, is companies pulling what is known as their guidance, right? Every quarter, companies come out and say, listen, we expect we're going to make 14 cents per share, and it's going to be a net revenue of $27,000 and whatever, right? All that stuff's going to be pulled because nobody has any idea of what earnings are going to be. And I think you're seeing that reflected in the volatility in the markets.
When you look at the way that the Trump administration has responded to this, it's gone from just even a week ago, it was a hoax, and now, they're talking about $1,000, giving $1,000 to each American to help them get through this. They're talking about, injecting trillions into different aspects of the government. I have a number of questions on this. And the first question is, where does this money come from and how much of there is it?
There is as much as we want because we're borrowing it all, right? We are borrowing it all. Now, one of the really good parts about this thing from that standpoint, right? Let's not sugarcoat this. But one of the really good parts about that is that interest rates are damn near zero, right? Money is basically free. The government can go out and borrow at 10%. Go out and borrow for 10 years at 1%, right? So the money's basically free, and we're going to be floating a whole lot more bonds to pay for all of this stuff, and the debt and the deficit are going to go up. But that's exactly why you want government borrowing. You want it in cases of systemic failure, which is what we're approaching here, right? And it's the same thing you saw in the financial crisis. This money you see the Federal Reserve injecting into the what are called the overnight repo markets, which I don't want to get into, but it's the guts and the plumbing of literally the financial system, how the banking system works. That's money that you need to be spending so the whole economy doesn't crash. It's not a $1.5 trillion debt-financed tax cut, which is what the Trump administration did at the end of 2017. So there are different kinds of debt. We are now piling on the good debt because it's systemically relevant.
So what happens, you know, I mean, we don't know what happens next, but at what point do we start to kind of really worry? I mean, I feel like, you know,
you like a week ago. You start to worry a week ago. No, seriously.
No, but I mean, if I go outside right now, you know, it's only, I'm in Los Angeles, the stores really kind of shut down yesterday.
Yep.
They're still doing takeout orders. You know, people's rent and mortgages aren't due for another 3 weeks,
right,
give or take.
Right.
And so at what point, like, where does it start to crumble? Because if you kind of look back over, you know, previous, and again, you said in the beginning of the show, like, that we have never seen anything like this before. But when you do look back to some of the things that are like it, you have a rise in crime, you have people that lose their jobs and have nowhere to turn. And I don't necessarily think that the Trump administration is going to, they are a very reactive, not a proactive administration,
right,
that doesn't think things through until after the fact. And even then, not even half the time. And so at what point do we kind of, does society collapse? Do airline businesses just kind of close up shop? Is Amazon the only company that actually is around? Like, how does this play out, do you think, as you kind of look at the financial aspect of it?
Yeah, so let me dodge that question, because frankly, the collapse of society is not something I'm prepared to deal with right now on day two of my kids being out of school and me having to work from home, right? But look, here's the challenge. And I'm stealing this from Joe Weisenthal at Bloomberg, who frankly stole it from somebody else. You have to think about this in two parallel time tracks, okay? There is economic time and there is financial time. Economic time is us going about our daily lives in whatever capacity we have. And right now, that capacity is hunkering down, drawing down our stores of food that we have, right? Using up whatever spare toilet paper we have hoarded, all of that. That is economic time. And we can sort of pause that if we need to, right? The problem is that financial time doesn't pause. Everybody has rent or mortgage or some kind of shelter payment that's due on the first of the month. Everybody has a paycheck that comes on the 15th and the 30th, right? Until they don't. And when financial time and economic time get out of whack, because people are hunkered down in economic time, but they can't do the work that gets them their paycheck in financial time, that's when things start going haywire. I don't know if the Trump administration and, frankly, the Congress of the United States, Republicans in the Senate, let's be clear, are going to be willing to take the steps that, say, Italy has taken. I don't know if you saw this, but about a week ago, the Italian government came out and said all mortgage payments, all rent payments, all store rent payments, all of that, they are stopped until we decide they are not stopped. And thus, financial time over there has been paused in a way. I don't know if that will work in this country.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again at an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Because when you look at the way that a lot of it's what's fascinating, I think, for me, is not just the it's almost like from a global perspective, you're seeing kind of A/B testing of what's working and what's not.
Yeah.
And you're also seeing the stupidity of most Americans, not most Americans, of some Americans who refuse to stay inside and, you know, think this is just a kind of a joke. But whereas in Italy, you know, everyone's listening to what they're supposed to do and also many other countries. But one of the things that I do think is different is we are a country that is primarily based on capitalism. I grew up in England where we had a national healthcare system, and in France it's a socialist. It's like you have all these different instances. And I wonder if you think that the capitalist version, like one thing that was so telling was Trump got up, I don't even know, days ago, however long it was ago, it feels like 45 years, but he got up there with the, you know, the heads of Boeing and the healthcare providers and all these different places. And he is kind of taking the approach of let business solve it, and that will keep the economy going. Whereas you have Italy that's taking the complete opposite approach, in England too. Do you think one breaks before the other, or is it we just have to wait and see how it plays out?
I think that's the name of the game with this thing, right? Is we have to wait to see how it plays out. But I guess I would just I would reframe what you said and maybe put it in the. Yes, it's capitalism, but it's also sort of that rugged individualism of the American psyche, right? And that's why you see, you know, all those people in Nashville the other night at that huge party. You see people, still young people, going out to bars and restaurants, right? It's, of course I can do this. This is America. I can do whatever I want. And I don't think people have realized, because we haven't had to in this country for a generation or more, have that collective sacrifice, which involves real sacrifice for the greater good. And I think that's a challenge. I will also say, just parenthetically, I think, you know, first of all, that meeting that Trump had in the Rose Garden with all those executives was only about 4 days ago, right? I think it was Friday. So it feels like years ago, but it was only Friday. I think he did that, frankly, because at that point he was still in denial and didn't really understand what had to be done. So he went through his corporate base and said, "Here, come stand with me in front of a microphone."
When you look at there's been the run on grocery stores and you know, I just went to the market this morning, and the only thing that's still sitting there is the creamy Alfredo sauce that no one wants and lettuce.
Yeah.
And
Brussels sprouts.
It is kind of how bad must you feel if you're the company that's you know, you see the picture of the empty aisle except for your product
and it's your stuff, right?
It's your stuff, but. That, you know, Trump has come out, you know, Gavin Newsom's come out, different people around the country have come out to say, hey, slow down, like, food's not going away. Yeah. Our systems are in place to keep that going. But if, you know, but is that true in some respects? I mean, we're a lot of the things that we're buying that are, you know, non-perishable, like, you know, canned goods and things like that.
Yeah.
They are things that have been sitting in ports. They have, you know, they're sitting in cargo bays from other countries and this, that, and the other. The same with products too. This is a question around that. At some point, those things are, you know, we're kind of borrowing time from the past to fill these shelves. At some point, are we going to run out of things? I mean, I imagine that the folks in Italy that are not going to make their pasta sauces are not going to be able to ship them out in 3 months, and therefore those things are not going to come over. And same with certain things coming from China that was slowed down. How does that all play out, this international trade and things just essentially not being made?
Yeah, so two things about international trade. The first is, let's remember this is coming on the heels of a trade war, right? And in point of fact, we still have tariffs on $360 billion worth of goods that we import from China. So that trade war is still going on. On the other slice of international trade in this thing, goods are still moving. There will be, I think, a disruption. I don't think food will not become available. I think the shortages you're seeing now are because we have fundamentally drawn down our inventories, right? And those inventories will continue to climb back up as things keep being made. There might be less of them made, or of whatever it is, the pasta sauce or you know, whatever, you know, snacks or treats we make in this country. They will eventually be made again, and people will be able to buy them. But I think we're going to have some momentary disruption. I don't think it's going to be systemic at all, though.
What are the, let's just say that, you know, this goes on. I mean, this is actually a question for you. How long, from the reports that you've read and all the news that you're consuming and the people you're spoken to, is there any concept of how long the economy comes to a stop for, or is it just, we just don't know?
No, I think it's, as Mnuchin said the other day, the Secretary of the Treasury, it's for a period of time, right? I mean, the government is directing parts of this government to shut down for a period of time until the curve flattens, right? And we've seen, you know, those curves of the infection rates, and that's what needs to happen. I don't think anybody can rationally put a time on this. I don't think Anthony Fauci could. I don't think Dr. Birx could. I don't think any of them could. Any of those people standing up behind Trump, for sure.
But so, when you talk about the fact that we've never seen anything like this before, yeah. are there economic models for something? I mean, I'm sure someone has thought something like this could happen before. I have friends that have worked on, you know, that wrote the movie Contagion. You know, this is not there's a documentary series on Netflix right now about pandemics. Like, this is not something that we knew something like this was eventually possible. Are there economic models for how something like this, how it breaks and how it gets fixed? I mean, does it completely change how we do business in the future, or is it just, we just don't know?
So two parts of that, right? One is, I don't know what the economic modeling says about the shutdown of the American economy, because I'm not sure anybody could have ever imagined it, although some bright PhD student probably did. But I think what you have to remember is this: once this economy resets and turns around and starts producing and functioning again, there are going to be companies and businesses that you know and I know and anybody who's listening to this know that are gone. The corner cafe may well be gone. The sneaker store on the corner may well be gone, because they're not structured to take a complete shutdown, right? And this goes to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier, right? Financial time. Your rent is due. And if this lasts 3 months and you've had no customers for 3 months, you can't pay your rent, your business doesn't get to continue, right? And that's why such emphasis is being put by the Trump administration finally on this $1 trillion bailout package they've gotten, most of which is hopefully direct loans and grants to people so that they can buy stuff and people can protect their businesses. On the other part of this, though, about what's the modeling, I'm gonna take it sideways. I had a conversation with Max Brooks today that we're going to put on Marketplace in a couple of days. Max Brooks, of course, is the guy who wrote World War Z and also the Zombie Survival Guide. And we got him on the phone because, first of all, I'm a fan of his books. I don't do scary zombie movies, but I do his books. and he has said that his books are not horror movies or books. They're not comedy. They are self-help books or how-to books, because we have a society, and these are his words, we have a society that is engineered for comfort and not for resilience. And I think that's the challenge here, right? We are now being pushed out of our comfort zone and having to become self-reliant and develop a sense of resilience. And I think that's going to be the challenge for this economy as we get going again.
I've been following you on Twitter for a long time, but this week you've been kind of the person I've been going to kind of try to understand the economic implications of all of this so much. It's just, you know, there's so much out there you don't know and don't understand, and it's just happening so quickly. And you, I think it was yesterday maybe, someone had tweeted something about, you know, by the end of the week, will we know if this is a recession? And you said it is 100%. At what point do we know when it's a recession? At what point do we know when it's depression? And what point do we know when it's worse than that?
So the official answer is that it's going to take a little while to actually know. There is a group of people that gets to decide when we're in a recession or worse. And it's a group called the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research. And they look at the trailing data and they say, okay, this is when unemployment went down. This is when consumer confidence went down. Boom. We are now in recession. And just to give you a sense of the lag, it was March or April of 2008 before they came out and said, okay, the recession started in December of 2007. Okay, so it's going to be a little while. And then, you know, they're not going to call it a depression or a great recession. They're just going to say this was the end of the previous expansion, right? That's the very dry clinical term for what's happening, right? The expansion is ending. We are at the end of the longest economic expansion we have had in this country, 11 years. So they're the ones who get to decide. And then how deep it gets is kind of out of anybody's control.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS. Just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you kind of look at all the talk to all these folks, and I can't wait to listen to that show, the World War C guy, because yeah. It makes complete sense. When you talk to all these folks and you hear about these things that are in the works, one of the things that we've been hearing a lot about this week, and I truly do believe that Andrew Yang deserves 99.9% of the credit for this.
Yeah, interesting.
Is
right?
Mnuchin
yeah.
coming out there? Talking about giving $1,000 to every family. Is it every family or every person?
Every person.
So if that's the case, does that slow this down? Does that slow Financial Time? Or is $1,000 not enough? And does it go away the second that, we start to go back outside again? Like, how does that play out?
Right. So look, I think it's important to draw this distinction between Andrew Yang and what's happening now. Andrew Yang was $1,000 a month for every person, right? The government plan now is $1,000 once, right, to get through the immediate squeeze. So it's important we not conflate what's happening now with what Andrew Yang proposed. And thus, fundamentally, it goes away. Will it stop Financial Time? No, because it's a one-time deal. Financial Time stops for nobody, man.
When you, last few questions for you before we let you go, but when you look at the way this has kind of unfolded in the past few days, and it's kind of been whiplash, there's a lot of, there's some jokes and it's like, especially on social media and people are trying to make the best of it and so on. When, is there a point when you look back at like the 1920s and the Great Depression and so on, is there a point where people start to panic, really panic, not just about toilet paper, but there's runs on the banks or, things like that?
Yeah. So that's a really good question because this was floating around out there a while ago. This is not yet a consumer financial crisis, right? You don't actually have banks failing. If you remember, and look, this happened to my bank, which was then Washington Mutual. We literally had banks failing, and JP Morgan bought Washington Mutual for pennies on the dollar. But I was not among those lining up because I remember that my money is federally guaranteed, right? You have the FDIC. Bank deposits for individuals are guaranteed. So that's not actually a problem. We don't have a consumer financial crisis quite yet. I don't frankly think we'll get there because all the people who are in charge now remember the financial crisis. So I don't think bank runs are a thing that's going to happen. I think what we really have to worry about is the lasting effect of parts of this economy shutting down, And then that becomes not a credit crisis, not a financial crisis, but it's a demand crisis. It's a consumer demand crisis that the government is trying to fix by sending everybody a check.
So every year we all get those alerts about the new jobs numbers in the United States, and every quarter they've been up. They've been 180,000, 220,000 new jobs, and when we see the impact of the coronavirus and how quickly it has happened, will we see the jobs numbers plummet immediately in the next jobs report, or will it be will there be a massive decline and then the following quarter? It'll be just devastating. How's it going to kind of play out as we look at the numbers and then the amount of jobless claims? Because when you look at a recession, which is 10% job declines, and a depression, which is 20%, it doesn't feel like we're going to get to that 20% instantly. Will it be gradual? Will it happen, like the snap of a finger? Is the next quarter going to be negative?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, for sure. We will have lost hundreds of thousands of jobs, right? The next jobs report comes out first Friday of April, whatever day that is, right? And it will undoubtedly be enormous because almost the entire month of March will have been consumed by this. Something to look at before that, and this podcast will drop on a Thursday, so there will be a number out this Thursday morning called First-Time Claims for Unemployment. And that's going to be a real tell as to how bad it's going to be. It's usually around plus or minus 200,000, 300,000 first-time claims for unemployment. People making their first trip to the unemployment office, right? You could see that spiking, doubling easy in the next report for sure. I think the April jobs report, the monthly report, is going to be terrible, truly.
When you are watching all of this and you're, you know, reporting on it on a daily basis, and there are certain companies that feel like they're actually going to kind of do somewhat well in this. There's Amazon, for example. Yeah. You know, there are the makers of ventilators and medical equipment. Is there a world where those companies actually, you know, their stock and their value goes up dramatically while everyone else is just plummets?
Well, I suppose. I mean, you know, capitalism is capitalism, right? And that's kind of the name of the game. Sorry, I'm stalling here because I'm looking up Amazon's share price right now and just to see what they did.
Well, it's kind of bobbed up and down. It's like, you know, they went up yesterday because they announced 100,000 new jobs, but it's still fallen with the market. But at the same time, like, you know, I wouldn't put money into anything. Not that I have money to put in anything, but like, I wouldn't be. But at the same time, it's, you know, there's certain people that I've heard say, Amazon stock's going to be through the roof. Can it be in this kind of climate? Can it still rise that much?
Yeah, of course it can. Right? I mean, you know.
Because capitalism is capitalism.
Just like the floor is zero, the upside is basically unlimited. Of course, you know, with leverage, the floor can be below zero. So, you know, anyway, that's kind of a technical answer. But of course it can go up.
When you when you look at where we are today, I mean, granted, Thursday is going to be dramatically different. At what point will you start to get nervous? You actually sound quite calm about everything, surprisingly. On Twitter, you sound a hell of a lot more nervous in words. Like, at what point do you, you know, at what point do you start to kind of say this is going to, is there an indicator in the markets, in, you know, is there anything that you can look at that is a number that is something that we should just kind of be worried about?
Yeah, so I'm going to hang my hat on the jobs numbers when they come out the first week of April. That's the thing to keep an eye on. Look, I have to be completely honest with you. I am able to look at the markets and look at all of this chaos, and I'm going to sound flip when I say it, but it's really the truth. My wife handles all of our money. And so I have no idea if she went to cash a year ago, whether we are up to our elbows in leverage. I couldn't tell you. I have no idea, and it's better that I don't know. But look, it's really important that I be clear. This recession is going to be really hard. It's going to be a deep recession. The only question is how long it takes to turn around. I think fundamentally, by the way, that since the economy was relatively strong going in, once we find the bottom, it's going to be relatively strong coming out too. But nobody should make any mistakes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we're going to have a short but deep recession. That's my guess, right? That's my guess. Whether my guess is worth more than anybody else's guess, I don't know.
Do you think that one thing that's really interesting is it's been the last couple of years really, but you know, essentially the end of 2019, there was and this is a two-part question. There was a huge push for, to essentially regulate these tech companies, right?
Yeah.
You know, let's go after Amazon, let's go after Facebook, you know, Google, and so on and so forth. Right now, if it wasn't for these companies, we'd be screwed, quite frankly. Like, we'd be sitting at home,
sure,
twiddling our thumbs, not able to watch Netflix or talk on social media or get toilet paper delivered, even though you can't actually get toilet paper delivered right now. But do you think that this goes away, if and when we come out of this, the talk of regulation goes away for these companies?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Because look, these companies are going to be bigger and stronger when we come out of this, right? Amazon is going to be bigger and stronger. And Netflix is going to have more people watching and chilling. And I think just the same way the calls for regulation of banks hasn't gone away, even though they've gotten bigger and stronger, I think the same thing is going to happen with these companies.
And at the same time, another aspect of this question is, you know, over the last year or two, we've been having these calls for, you have these workers for Uber and the delivery drivers that drop off our food and so on and so forth, and the fact that they don't have health insurance and they don't have, you know, any security in case of job loss, and which is now happening to them.
Yeah.
Do you think that this will give the government or frankly these companies more pressure to actually change the way they employ these people, or
I mean, you'd hope so, right? Because, and I don't know where I saw it on Twitter today, but somebody pointed out that these, you know, the Uber drivers and the Uber Eats folks, and, you know, the people who are making the deliveries of the toilet paper that we can't buy, they are in many ways in this phase of this crisis the first responders, you know, for consumers who are locked in their homes and societies that are largely self-isolating. These are the folks who are getting us what we need. And one hopes that as we come out of this, there will be some recognition of that essential function that they have come to serve. I don't know.
All right, last two questions for you. The first one is, and I know you're not a financial planner, so maybe you can ask your wife, but one of the things that I've kind of struggled with a little bit is, like, I'm a writer. I'm still getting a paycheck. I work from home. I have done for many, many years.
Yeah.
There's part of me that wants to go out and keep stimulating the economy and, like, getting food delivered and you know, anything that I can do, buying a new sweater on Etsy, you know, but is that the right thing to be doing, or should I be saving my money because I could be laid off in 2 months? How do you, like, what's the advice on how to deal with that kind of question?
Yeah. So I have no advice to give. I have my personal perspective, and that is this: you protect yourself, but you do well by others. And if you can buy a sweater on Etsy, or even if you can't go to a restaurant for dinner, buy a gift card at that restaurant and then go in 3 months and spend that money there, then do that, right? Do that.
Yeah. 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 All right. Any parting sage words of advice or thoughts from this whole thing as we wrap up?
No, I just think, you know, as hard as it is, you got to know what the news is. But I think really you don't have to know what it is all the time. Just check in once or twice a day and then, you know, take care of yourself. Because this is, as I said, this is day two for me with the kids home from school, and it's already brutal. And I, you know, we're all in this together, man.
I'm gonna turn that advice back around on you and tell you to get off Twitter for 5 minutes every day.
I will do that.
But
thanks, Nick.
But I need to follow you to know what's going on and with all the financial news. So thanks, Kai, so much. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Thanks to my guest today, Kai Ryssdal. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. And thank you, of course, to my listeners. I know this is a very difficult, troubling time. But, you know, try to read something that's not the news every once in a while. Go read a book, watch a movie, play with your kids, learn to play piano or the flute or something, and wash your hands and stay indoors. I'll see you all next week.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.